Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about why the cost of data breaches has gone up during the pandemic, and we'll also be discussing quite a bit about ransomware. But first, US authorities have come out with a few announcements in the last few weeks relating to Chinese threat actors, and Bridget can tell us all about it.
Yeah, as you say, there's been a few announcements over the last couple of weeks. So US authorities revealed last week, I think, that Chinese state-sponsored threat actors had targeted 23 US oil and gas pipeline operators in attack campaigns between 2011 and 2013, and that they'd actually successfully compromised 13 of them. So this news came out in the joint report that was issued by CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and by the FBI. And it revealed that the campaign, which previously had been unreported, led to 13 confirmed compromises, then 3 what were described as near misses, and 7 incidents where the depth of intrusion achieved by the attackers was unknown. So obviously it's possible they were also successful compromises, and it's just not confirmed. And the activity was described in the report as a spear phishing and intrusion campaign, with the attackers reportedly exfiltrating data from the infected networks. And the information that it appeared they were interested in was SCADA-related information, things like personnel lists, credentials, as well as system manuals. And however, CISA and the FBI did say, though, that as far as they could tell, the threat actors didn't make any attempt to modify the actual pipeline operations of any of the systems that they accessed. However, they did say that they believed that the actors were specifically targeting US pipeline infrastructure for what they described as the purpose of holding US pipeline infrastructure at risk, and that this activity was ultimately intended, they said, to help China develop cyber attack capabilities against US pipelines and to physically damage those pipelines or potentially to disrupt pipeline operations. Now, obviously, this report is kind of particularly interesting in the wake of the, you know, much discussed Colonial Pipeline incident that occurred in May. Now, obviously, we know that it was Russian-based cyber criminals who were behind that attack, that it was a ransomware, financially motivated ransomware attack ultimately. But it is interesting to note, I suppose, that oil and gas pipeline operations were of interest to state-backed actors as long back as 10 years ago, which is obviously quite a while. So obviously, those kind of businesses have been on the radar of cyber actors for a long time. And this report actually came out on the same day that the US itself announced new regulations for pipeline operators to help guard against cyber attacks. And these new guidelines were really, you know, issued in the wake of the Colonial Pipeline attack in May, which, you know, so raised awareness of these kinds of attacks and the serious repercussions that they could have. So the kind of repercussions of that attack do continue to reverberate as well.
Yeah, and the US government seems to be fairly busy in recent weeks because they also came out with quite a significant statement regarding the Microsoft Exchange server attacks.
Yeah, they formally attributed those recent Microsoft Exchange server attacks to what they described as individuals associated with China's Ministry of State Security. And in the statement, which they published kind of in conjunction with some of their allies, including members of the Five Eyes coalition, the EU and NATO, the US government said it had high confidence that China was behind the attacks, alleging that the ministry had used contractors to stage this attack, as well as a number of other attacks, some of which, including a ransomware attack against an American company, they said had been performed in order to enrich officials at the Ministry of State Security. And we know that when the attacks were first discovered, Microsoft did say that these vulnerabilities were being exploited by a Chinese advanced persistent threat group that it had dubbed Hafnium, or which we could track our ANT, in targeted attacks. And now we do have this official attribution as well, even though obviously we know that once these vulnerabilities were unveiled, we did see many different threat actors rushing to exploit them as well. And the day after the US made this official attribution about these attacks, they also released an advisory detailing the TTPs used by Chinese state-sponsored cyber actors in multiple other attacks. So the joint advisory was issued by the NSA and by CISA and the FBI, and it listed over 50 TTPs, tactics, tools and procedures, the most significant of which was the exploitation of public vulnerabilities within very short time period after their disclosure, often in major applications that we would have heard mentioned before, such as PulseSecure and Apache, as well as the Microsoft software, like we already mentioned. Yeah, so a lot of announcements from US authorities recently relating to Chinese state actors, which is quite interesting. It's interesting to see that level of attribution coming from authorities in the US at the moment.
Yeah, indeed, it always is. And they're kind of putting their money where their mouth is, because they said they would offer rewards for information about these state-backed actors too.
Yeah, so the US State Department said that it's going to offer rewards of up to $10 million, so really significant amounts of money, for information about state-backed hackers who attempt to disrupt critical infrastructure. And they announced that the State Department's Rewards for Justice Office will run the program. And I think that office exists to pay out for kind of tips related to kind of terrorist campaigns and stuff traditionally. But now it's been expanded to do this campaign as well. And they said that they've even set up a Tor-based web portal to facilitate anonymous tips. And they've also said the rewards can be paid out in cryptocurrency. So they're really trying to encourage, I suppose, people to come forward with information. And the agency listed ransomware, extortion, hacking, or exceeding authorization on protected computers or transmitting malicious code as potential violations that, if they were carried out under the direction or control of a foreign government, as relevant threats that they want to get information about, basically, under this program. And obviously this comes in the wake of things like the Colonial Pipeline attack, you know, like the attack on JBS Foods, which is a major food processor in the US, you know, which at the time when they occurred, you know, even though they weren't state-backed attacks, you know, there was concerns that they could affect the fuel and food supply chains in the US. So, you know, it's clear that this is a big area of concern for US authorities now, that these kind of critical infrastructure businesses could be kind of a target of both state-backed actors and cyber criminals.
Yeah, it's really got their attention.
Definitely has. And now, Dick, speaking of cyber criminals and ransomware, let's turn to you, because you've been looking into ransomware a good bit this week, I think. And as usual, there seems to be a lot going on.
Yes, indeed, there sure is. And it's been an unusual few weeks, because by the looks of it, there's actually a lot of change happening in the ransomware landscape. So anyway, the first thing to mention is that we have had what may be the final chapter in the Cassia ransomware attack. That's something we were discussing on the podcast 2 weeks ago, I think. But to recap for those who weren't listening, this attack occurred in the first week of July. It was essentially ransomware that was delivered in a supply chain attack. The attack involved the exploitation of what was then a zero-day vulnerability in Cassia VSA software. And that was used to compromise victim organizations via multiple managed service providers who actually use that software. The attackers who were using the Sodino Kiwi ransomware are believed to have infected at least 1,500 organizations worldwide. And a lot of the processes appeared to be automated, and the ransomware was triggered simultaneously across all of the victim organizations, presumably to give victims no forewarning of the attack. The attack indeed may have been timed to coincide with the 4th of July holiday weekend in the US, which is where most of the victim organizations were located. Anyway, Leaf Roller, which is our name for the group that is behind the Sodino Kiwi ransomware, went offline 2 weeks after the attack. And the reason for this disappearance kind of remains unclear at the moment. And it's unknown indeed if it was just a coincidence or on the timing, or if it was linked in any way to the Cassia attack, whether it was because of the attack or whether the attack was kind of a final blow struck by the group. So the latest development in the story is that late last week, Cassia said that it had acquired a universal decryptor for the ransomware. And it said it acquired the decryptor from a trusted third party, and it was now sharing it with all affected customers. So following the attack, it was reported that the attackers had demanded $70 million for a universal decryptor, $5 million for encryption for each of the MSPs affected, or $40,000 for each encrypted computer. Now, Kaseya last week, when they made the announcement, said they could neither confirm nor deny that they had paid the ransom to obtain the decryption tool. Now, of course, in circumstances like this, the assumption always is, oh, they paid the ransom. But I think one little wrinkle to that assumption maybe is that the Leafgrower group has since departed the scene. And frequently, when groups like this go offline, they do release decryption keys, often for nothing. So, you know, that is a possibility as well.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably just going to remain a bit of a mystery. And I guess the other big question is whether the people behind Sudden Okibi are really gone, or whether we'll see them return again with some new ransomware, as has happened so often.
Yeah, I think it would be dangerous to assume that they're gone. I think invariably they always return in some guise or another. And I think one of the attackers behind Sudden Okibi once said in an interview that attackers always return, even if they claim they're retiring. They can't resist the lure of more money. But I do think we are seeing something of a changing of the guard right now with ransomware, or at least one of those kind of periodic realignments, because a lot of the more prolific threat actors have gone quiet. So not only is Sudden Okibi gone, but last month in early June, the Avedon group announced that it was halting its operations and it released decryption keys. We also, earlier in the year, had the apparent departure of the Egregor ransomware group with a report of a cessation of activity. And Sudden Okibi and Avedon alone, they accounted for a significant portion of the ransomware marketplace in recent months, if you want to call that, so prior to their departure. So, not surprisingly, we're seeing a bunch of new threat actors springing up now in recent weeks, trying to claim a piece of the action. So just this morning, I was reading on Recorded Future that a new ransomware group calling itself Black Matter was currently recruiting affiliates on the Exploit and XSS underground forums. Black Matter, they appear to be quite well resourced, certainly if their claims are to be believed. They were advertising for what they call access brokers, people who could provide them with an entryway onto companies with revenues of at least $100 million a year and between 500 and 15,000 hosts. And potential targets, they said, should be located in the US, the UK, Canada, or Australia. And in return for that, the group was willing to pay up $100,000 for access. So, you know, if these claims are true, they're probably veteran cyber criminals, because people who are new to this game probably don't have that much, that amount of money to be offering up. They claim they're going to be able to encrypt multiple operating systems and architectures, including Windows, lots of different versions of Linux, VMware, and various NAS devices. And then only earlier this week, there was a bit of news from Malwarebytes about Avos Locker, which is another new ransomware group that's emerged in recent years. And they too have been advertising on underground forums looking for what they called pen testers with Active Directory network experience and access brokers. Malwarebytes said Avos Locker is ransomware that's written in C++, and they said they could offer affiliates access to the ransomware itself, and then assistance and communications with victims and hosting for stolen data. So the real classic ransomware as a service business model. And then today, another new ransomware family appeared called Haron. It was discovered by the South Korean security firm S2W Labs, who said it was kind of fairly unsophisticated and relied heavily on borrowed code from older ransomware groups. But it just kind of goes to show that that seems to be a lot of people trying to get in on the market now at the moment, given that there's been so many departures.
Yeah, and would you say the departure of these kind of more, I suppose, experienced ransomware gangs is good news?
I mean, you know, it's always good to see an active threat group gone, but I am going to say on balance, maybe not really, because as time goes by, the TTPs used by established groups kind of get known, and defenders tend to get better at spotting their activity. And any change in the threat landscape means there's going to be a period of uncertainty where nobody really knows yet who the big players are going to be and what tactics they're going to use.
That's true. Yeah, it's kind of more uncharted territory.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been doing some research yourself into ransomware activity recently, haven't you?
I have, for my sins, yeah. I've been working on our latest ransomware white paper, which we are planning to share with our customers in early September. It's kind of an annual event at this stage. I think this is like the fourth one that I've been involved in producing.
Yeah, the resident expert at this stage. And is there anything you can share yet from it?
Well, it's still a work in progress, but I think there's a few things we could talk about. Obviously, we can go into it in more depth when the paper is done. But one of the things I was looking at this week was seeing if we could measure what the top TTPs used in targeted ransomware attacks are. So to do that, we did a run through of all of the ransomware investigations we've done in recent months. And from those investigations where we found precursor tools or tactics, we just did a rough count on them.
Okay, right. And what did you find?
Well, the top five were Cobalt Strike, which was present in 41% of organizations. It was followed by PSExec, which we found in 33% of investigations. And then kind of joined third were NetScan, Mimikatz, and AdFind, which were all present in around 15% of investigations. So I'm going to say it probably, you know, if you'd asked me to guess beforehand what the top TTPs were, I would have probably, a lot of those I would have listed out. You know, I've kind of seen them a lot, cropping up a lot in ransomware investigations. Cobalt Strike is a very popular tool. It's essentially commodity malware. You know, it can be used to, you know, open a back door on victims' machines. And it's quite popular in that, like, you know, it's off the shelf and there's lots of features that are of interest to attackers. I think they can recompile a new version for each attack. So you can kind of have a previously unseen version of Cobalt Strike to use for yourself. Mimikatz, you know, I think we've talked a lot about it on the podcast before. You know, it's probably the most popular credential dumping tool that we've seen in targeted attacks. PSExec is actually part of the Windows operating system. It's a Microsoft SysInternals tool. Again, very popular with ransomware attackers because it could be used for executing processes on other systems. So, you know, kind of comes in handy when you want to run ransomware on other computers or on a network that you've broken into. NetScan was something I probably wasn't as familiar with. It's a publicly available tool. It's a full name is Soft Perfect Network Scanner, and it's used for the discovery of host names and network services. And then AdFind, another tool that we're seeing kind of cropping up a lot more in the past year or so. Again, not really malware. It's just like one of these kind of freely available tools that is a dual use, and it can be used to query the Active Directory.
Right, very good. And then were there any other interesting bits that the research has thrown up?
Yeah, we do try and track the activity of each threat actor. And that can be quite tricky to do because I guess if you're just looking purely at telemetry, there's only a small minority of cases or attacks where the payload is positively identified as belonging to a particular threat actor or other. And that's because attacks are frequently blocked either before the payload is executed, in which case you wouldn't be even be able to confirm whether it was definitely a ransomware attack or not, or they're blocked at the payload stage by a generic detection that's just for any kind of ransomware. So, but going on cases where we could positively identify a payload, if you look at, say, the first half of this year, we found that the most prolific threat actors have been Sodina Kibi, Ryuk, Comte, Avedon, and DarkSide. And I think what's notable about that is that at this point in time, at least, of those threats, only Ryuk and Comte, both of which are controlled by a single actor, it's widely believed, are actually still active. So it kind of ties back with the point I made earlier about how there's a gap in the market as such, and we're probably going to see a lot of people trying to fill it. Anyway, I'm sure we'll be talking
more. That is interesting, all right.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next few months, whether some of those prolific actors kind of come back with new tool sets, or whether you're going to see what could be a completely new group of people taking control of the ransomware landscape. I'm sure we'll be talking some more about ransomware when the paper is done, or indeed whenever next time. But let's move on to the next item, because we wanted to talk about data breaches. And that's because there was a recent report that said the cost of data breaches for businesses has actually soared during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, so IBM Security released its annual cost of a data breach report this week. And it found that the average cost of data breaches actually hit a record high over the last year, so during the pandemic. So in 2021, a typical data breach experienced by companies cost in the region of $4.24 million per incident, which IBM says is now 10% higher than it was in 2020 for breaches that involved less than 100,000 records. And then the cost of the kind of mega breaches, you know, that involve the exposure of more than 50 million records, say, you know, they come with a higher price tag again, costing an average of $400 million to resolve, or just over that. And IBM said that what they described as drastic operational shifts that were created due to the pandemic, you know, so obviously work from home and the need for businesses often to kind of quickly change their processes to allow for remote working, led to higher costs and then made it harder to contain security incidents as well once they occurred. And IBM said the businesses that reported working from home at, you know, when these security incidents occurred, you know, incurred costs of roughly $1 million more than what had been averaged up to that point. So it just seemed that the work from home element of things did play a part there. And the report also said that compromised credentials were the most common attack vector seen in these attacks. So often these credentials might have been, you know, like people reusing credentials that were then maybe leaked on the day of the breach and then, you know, basically stolen and reused. And when the attackers gained access then, in close to half of the cases, it was customer PII like names and email addresses that were stolen. And the report also said that it was the healthcare industry that had the most expensive data breaches, which on an average cost over $9 million, followed by financial services, where the average cost was $5.72 million, and pharmaceuticals at just over $5 million. Interesting to see healthcare and pharmaceuticals in there, considering obviously there will be two industries that would have been under a lot of pressure, I suppose, over the last year and a half. And the impact of work from home, you know, on the cost there is definitely interesting, because for sure we have seen the work from home have an impact in other ways. You know, when we see increased targeting of kind of VPN services and cloud services over the last year and things like that, and definitely the impact, I suppose, of businesses having to change so quickly from the kind of in-office model to the work from home model has definitely had a cybersecurity impact as well.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, I would say it's less maybe working from home and more the sort of unplanned nature of it, the fact that businesses suddenly had to scramble and shift to a different business model. And I'd say if they had more time to prepare for it, it may not have been quite as impactful. Okay, that's about all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at ThreatIntel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We are going to be taking a little bit of a summer break for the next while, but we're going to be back again on September 23rd. So until then, thank you and goodbye.